Finest Studios presents a preview of How Harmony Happens, a fable for hacking the conflict cycle. Written by Peter John Schrock. Narrated by James Reeder. Copyright 2026. All rights reserved. No portion of this audiobook may be copied, distributed, or reproduced without prior written consent from the publisher.
Chapter 1. The Disconnect.
The laptop screen went dark the instant Bruce's hand touched the doorframe. He stepped into his son's room, keeping his voice careful and measured. "Caleb, what are you working on?" Caleb's fingers slammed the laptop shut with more force than necessary. "Nothing." "Didn't look like nothing." Bruce moved closer, eyeing the closed laptop on the bed. "You seemed pretty focused." "I said it's nothing, Dad." Caleb's jaw clenched, his eyes fixed on the wall behind Bruce. Bruce stepped back into the doorway. "Son, if something's going on..."
"Nothing's going on."
Caleb's voice cracked as he stood, snatching the laptop and clutching it against his chest. "Why do you always assume I'm doing something wrong?"
"I'm not assuming anything."
Bruce held up his hands, palms out. "I'm just trying to..."
"Trying to what?"
"Control everything." Caleb's face twisted with frustration. "You can't just barge into my room and..."
"This is my house, Caleb."
The words came out sharper than Bruce intended. "I have every right to know what you're doing in here at midnight."
Caleb's face flushed red.
"You don't trust me. You never trust me."
"That's not fair."
Bruce's voice rose to match his son's. "I'm trying to help."
"I don't need your help."
Caleb reached out toward the door. "I just need you to leave me alone."
"Caleb, wait."
The door slammed shut. Bruce jumped back, narrowly avoiding getting hit. He ran his fingers through his hair and exhaled slowly. His feet carried him to the living room on autopilot. He sank into the worn leather chair, her chair, and dropped his head into his hands. What was he doing wrong? No matter what he tried, no matter how carefully he chose his words, they always ended up here. The doorbell chimed. It was 10:47 p.m. A familiar voice called through the door.
"Bruce?"
"It's Maggie. I know it's late, but I saw your light on." He stepped aside, and she moved past him without waiting for an invitation, heading straight for the kitchen the way she always did. She set a plate on the counter and turned to face him.
"Snickerdoodles, Caleb's favorite. I heard the shouting from my car."
"What happened?" Bruce slumped against the counter. "Same thing. I walk in, he shuts down. I push a little, he explodes. I'm his father. I'm supposed to help him, and I don't know how anymore."
He shook his head.
"His mother knew how to reach him. I'm just the one who messes it up." Maggie pulled out two kitchen chairs and sat in one, patting the other. He obeyed, feeling like a child himself. She folded her hands on the table, her voice soft. "My late husband Edmund was a wonderful pastor. Gifted man. But early on, he had a habit of correcting people before he really understood them. He'd hear two sentences and already be solving the problem." She met Bruce's eyes. "It took him years to learn that you can't reach someone you haven't first connected with." Bruce opened his mouth to respond, but the soft padding of feet stopped him. Caleb appeared in the kitchen doorway, his eyes red. A cluster of colorful carabiners hung from his belt loop, each one clipping something different. His house key, a small flashlight, his earbuds in their case. When he saw Maggie, his expression softened, just a fraction, but enough to notice.
"Hey, Grandma Maggie,"
His voice was quiet and a little shy. "Hello, sweetheart," Maggie's voice lit up. "Fresh snickerdoodles, just for you." Caleb crossed to the counter and took a cookie, his shoulders relaxing slightly. "Thanks." "You're welcome, dear." Maggie stood and kissed the top of his head. "It's time for bed." She looked at Bruce for agreement, and Bruce nodded back. "Now get some sleep. It's late."
"Okay."
Caleb took two more cookies and headed back toward his room. He paused at the doorway, glancing at Bruce. For a moment, it looked like he might say something. Then he pressed his eyes shut and disappeared down the hall. His bedroom door clicked shut. Not a slam this time. Just a quiet, final closing. Bruce stared at the empty doorway. "Did you see that? He was completely different with you." Maggie gathered her purse from the counter. "Maybe because I wasn't trying to correct him before I connected with him." Bruce turned to face her. "What does that mean?"
"It means what it sounds like."
She placed a hand on his shoulder. "Try connecting first, Bruce, before you correct. That's where it starts." She stepped outside, and the door closed behind her with a soft click. Bruce stood alone in the kitchen with a plate of cookies and the quiet of the house settling around him. Down the hall, his son's light was still on. He reached for a snickerdoodle, but the sweetness tasted bitter in his mouth. Chapter 2. The Defacing. Jason Park's coffee was still hot when he clicked the mouse to wake up his computer. The Riverside High School homepage bloomed across his monitor, and a slow smile spread across Jason's face. A student stood in the center of the screen, grinning maniacally as he held a flaming torch to a stack of textbooks. The flames looked almost real, dancing with AI-generated precision. The text beneath read, "Learning is burning." Jason leaned back in his chair and let out a long, satisfied laugh. He scrolled down, savoring each new modification as it appeared. Principal Hawkins's official photo had been transformed. Gone was the stern, bearded administrator. In his place stood a balding man in a bright pink tutu, hands on his hips, long flowing hair cascading over his shoulders. The caption read, "Principal Ballerina Hawkins, Dancing Through Education." "Beautiful," Jason murmured, shaking his head with what looked like admiration. "Just beautiful." He scrolled further, taking his time with each image. The school mascot, a fierce grizzly bear, now wore heart-shaped sunglasses and held a bouquet of daisies. The faculty directory photos had all been given oversized cartoon eyes. The About Our School section now claimed Riverside High was the premier institution for underwater basket weaving and competitive napping. The modifications were seamless. Honestly, Jason thought, the school site had never looked better. No real damage was done. It was just a brilliant, harmless prank. He leaned closer to the screen, studying each detail, admiring every change that had been made. He started to laugh again when his office door banged open. Principal Hawkins stood in the doorway, with his face the color of an overripe tomato, unfortunately bearded and tragically not wearing a tutu. "Park!" His voice could have shattered glass. "What is the meaning of this?" Jason's laughter died in his throat, and he minimized the browser window. Too late. The principal had already seen him enjoying the spectacle. A spike of genuine fear shot through Jason. Hawkins was petty, vindictive, and fully capable of making his life miserable. "Sir, I was just looking at what happened," Jason said, forcing his expression into something more serious.
"You were just laughing."
Hawkins stormed into the office, jabbing a finger at Jason's monitor. "Someone is humiliating me, humiliating this entire school, and you're sitting here laughing about it?
I apologize, sir. Jason kept his voice level, but something flickered in his eyes.
I'll fix it right away.
You'll do more than fix it.
Hawkins slammed his palm on Jason's desk, making the coffee mug jump.
You'll find whoever did this and make them pay. Do you understand me?
I want them expelled, arrested, prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
Jason swallowed a sigh.
Prosecuted for a tutu picture? The man needs to lighten up.
I will take care of it, sir, but we really need to fix the underlying problem, Jason said, trying to navigate the minefield.
This system has security holes.
He had inherited this mess of administrative school software and had been complaining about the vulnerabilities he had found since day one. No one was actually doing something about it, and now they were getting what they deserved.
As I told you before, just fix it. I want this person found.
Hawkins's breath was coming fast, his face still dangerously red.
This is an attack on me personally, on my reputation, on my authority.
I'll check everything and get back to you with what I find, Jason said, keeping his tone carefully compliant.
I want them today, Park. Today.
Hawkins spun toward the door, then turned back, with his finger pointed like a weapon.
And get that garbage off my website immediately. Every minute it's up is another minute I'm being mocked.
The door slammed behind him hard enough to rattle Jason's coffee mug against his desk.
Jason sat back in his chair and exhaled slowly, his eyes returning to the screen.
He'd been the technology director at Riverside High for 3 years now, and in that time, he'd learned two important things about Principal Hawkins.
First, the man was vindictive, and if you crossed him, he would make your life miserable.
Second, he cared more about his image than about actual education. The man ran the school like his own personal kingdom, and anyone who challenged him paid the price.
Jason pulled up the modification logs, fully expecting the digital equivalent of a blank piece of paper. He wasn't disappointed.
Just as he suspected, all that anyone could see looking at the logs was that the site had been modified at 11:47 p.m. last night. There was no trail to follow, and no evidence.
The system recorded no IP addresses and no real user attribution.
All he saw was the generic user identification that he had renamed to bogus_user_01.
Jason let out a breath that was half sigh, half chuckle.
He had an overwhelming urge to march into Hawkins's office and shout, "I told you so." He had warned the board that this legacy system was a complete joke. Now, Hawkins wanted him to play detective, with zero clues. His investigation was going to be an absolute farce, but he needed to humor Principal Hawkins until he settled down.
He started the rollback process, watching as the AI-generated chaos disappeared from the screen, replaced by the boring, official content.
Then he initiated a forced password reset for Principal Hawkins's account.
He did it every single time the man yelled at him. It wouldn't catch the hacker, but watching the principal struggle to create his sixth new password this month was a perk of the job that never got old.
A notification popped up on his screen, showing an email from Principal Hawkins to all faculty. The subject line read, "Cyber attack, all hands on deck," in capital letters.
Jason skimmed the email, rolling his eyes at the bombastic tone, the threatening language, and the excessive use of capital letters and exclamation points.
The message was clear. Find the perpetrator, or else.
Another email notification popped up on his screen. This one was from Mrs. Rivera, the psychology teacher down the hall.
The email was brief. "Jason, I am having trouble entering my grades again. I need your help. I think I am missing a step after the last update, Jason glanced at the useless website logs still open on his screen. He had real work to do, a completely pointless investigation to make, and a principal breathing down his neck. He responded to Laura, "I can help later today." The clacking of the keys stopped as he pushed the button to send. His phone buzzed with a calendar reminder that read, "Staff meeting, 2 p.m. Principal's office." He glanced at the clock and saw that he had 3 hours. 3 hours to come up with some kind of technobabble that would satisfy Hawkins without actually pointing the finger at anyone for a harmless prank. Jason pulled up his second monitor and opened a blank document titled, "Incident Investigation Report." He stared at it for a moment, wondering how he was going to spin a complete lack of data into a 3-page document that would satisfy Hawkins's bruised ego. There was absolutely no way to know who did this. It could be a student, a teacher, or a random teenager in another country. Jason typed a few generic sentences about analyzing server vulnerabilities. He just had to make sure he looked busy enough that when Hawkins inevitably demanded a scapegoat, it wouldn't be him. Chapter 3. Untouchable Bullies. The bell rang, sharp and final, cutting through the noise of Riverside High's third-floor hallway. Caleb slid into his seat in Mrs. Rivera's psychology class, just as two boys darted through the door, rushing to their desks with matching smirks. They made it with seconds to spare, throwing themselves into chairs near the back corner. "Good morning, everyone." Mrs. Rivera's voice was warm, but firm. "Please take out your books and turn to Chapter 7. We'll be discussing cognitive biases today." The classroom settled into the familiar rhythm of shuffling papers and unzipping backpacks. Then the door banged open, and Tyler stumbled in with his hair plastered to his head, water dripping onto his t-shirt. His face was flushed, his eyes wild. The two boys in the back corner erupted into laughter. "Nice shower, Tyler," one of them called out. "Did someone forget their umbrella?" the other added, his voice dripping with mock sympathy. Derek leaned back in his chair and sneered. "Looks like you lost your VIP protection, Tyler. Word is that your mom's lawyer is trying to take everything, so I guess you are basically a nobody now." Laura's expression hardened. She crossed the room in 3 quick strides and stepped into the hallway with Tyler, pulling the door closed behind her. Through the small window in the door, Caleb could see them talking. Tyler's shoulders shook, while Mrs. Rivera put a hand on his arm, her face gentle. She was listening. The two boys in the back were still snickering, whispering to each other. Caleb's grip on his pencil became a stranglehold. He knew exactly what had happened. Tyler had been heading to class when those two cornered him in the bathroom, shoved his head in the sink, and turned on the water. They'd done it before, and they'd do it again. Nothing would happen to them, because nothing ever did. The door opened, and Mrs. Rivera stepped back inside, alone. "Where's Tyler?" someone asked. Tyler needed to speak with Principal Hawkins. Laura's voice was carefully neutral, but Caleb caught the flash of anger in her eyes. "Let's get started." She pulled out a stack of papers from her desk. "Here are your test results from last week." Caleb zoned out as she moved through the aisles, handing back tests. "Caleb." Mrs. Rivera's voice was soft as she placed his test face down on his desk. Laura leaned down, her voice low enough that only he could hear. "I know you know this stuff. What's going on?" Caleb met her eyes, seeing genuine concern there and feeling something twist in his chest. "I don't care," he muttered, speaking loud enough for the boys in the back to hear. "Nothing is fair here. Those jerks over there are untouchable." He kept his gaze locked on her face, actively testing her. He was throwing out a negative connection cue. She had taught them earlier this semester that people constantly sent out these subtle signals when they desired connection or needed someone to notice them. He knew the pattern perfectly, contrasting her teaching with how his dad always missed these signals at home. Instead of engaging, his dad constantly responded with a bond breaker, shutting down the conversation, acting defensively, or simply ignoring the cue altogether. Those dismissive actions were creating an emotional chasm between them. Caleb had thrown his own complaint to Laura like a gauntlet, waiting to see if she would practice what she preached. He expected her to deliver a bond breaker of her own by criticizing the bad test grade or ignoring the signal completely. Laura did not pull away or dismiss his frustration. She leaned closer to his desk, catching the cue and choosing to act with a bond builder instead. She was doing exactly what she had taught, by recognizing his signal and intentionally engaging with him in his frustration. "I will take care of those guys," she said, keeping her voice quiet and steady, while offering a safe space for him to vent. Caleb looked up, surprised by her response. He wanted to believe her, but he'd heard promises like that before. "Good luck." He turned back to his test, tracing the red D with his finger. Laura straightened and returned to the front of the class. For the next 40 minutes, she taught about cognitive biases. Caleb listened with half his attention, since he already knew most of it. He'd read the textbook cover to cover in the first week of school. The bell rang, and students gathered their things as the classroom erupted into noise and movement. Caleb was shoving his notebook into his backpack when one of the boys from the back corner appeared beside him. "Hey, Caleb." Derek Hawkins, the principal's nephew, stood there with his arms crossed. Caleb didn't look up. "What?" Derek leaned over the desk, a sneer playing on his lips. "Heard you ratted us out to Mrs. Rivera." Caleb kept his eyes glued to his notebook. "I didn't say anything." "That's not what it sounded like." Derek's friend, Chase Brennan, appeared on Caleb's other side. He was another privileged kid who thought the rules didn't apply to him. "I said the truth." Caleb slung his backpack over his shoulder, the carabiners clipped to the strap, jingling softly. "You guys are untouchable." "Smart kid." Derek's smile was sharp. "Keep it that way." They moved toward the door, where Laura stood. Caleb watched as Derek paused beside her. "Mrs. Rivera." Derek's voice was loud enough for half the class to hear. "Just so you know, my uncle is the principal, and his brother is the school superintendent. They're very interested in teacher performance reviews this year." Laura's face went pale, her hand gripping the doorframe. "My dad's a lawyer," Chase added, grinning. "Specializes in wrongful termination suits." Derek leaned closer to Laura, his voice dropping just loud enough for Caleb to hear. "Just try it, and we'll make you lose your job." They walked past her into the hallway, laughing. Laura stood frozen in the doorway. Caleb moved toward the door, his chest tight with anger. As he passed Laura, Derek and Chase were waiting in the hall. Chase stepped into his path and jabbed a finger toward Caleb's chest. "You're next, Caleb. Keep your mouth shut, or you'll get worse than what Tyler got." They walked away, still laughing. Caleb stood in the hallway, his hands trembling. Behind him, Laura was gathering papers from her desk, her movements jerky and sharp. He could see the frustration radiating off her in waves. She wanted to help, and Caleb believed that. But she was as powerless as he was. Derek and Chase were right. They were untouchable.
Caleb walked down the hallway toward his locker, his mind already spinning with possibilities. If the system wouldn't stop them, maybe he could. If no one else would make things fair, maybe he'd have to do it himself. His phone buzzed with a text from Tyler that read, "Suspended for 2 days. Hawkins said I was disruptive." Caleb stared at the message, his hand forming a fist. He banged the locker next to him. Tyler got punished, while the bullies walked free. The word untouchable burned in his mind as he headed to his next class, but everyone had vulnerabilities. Caleb just had to find them. Once he did, maybe untouchable wouldn't be so untouchable anymore. Chapter 4. Wrong Target. Laura Rivera's hands were shaking as she pushed open the door to Principal Hawkins's office. She had taught at Riverside High for 5 years, and in that time, she had learned to navigate the political landscape, to keep her head down, and to pick her battles. This situation with Tyler was simply too much to ignore. "Where is Tyler?" She didn't wait for an invitation to speak, letting her frustration bleed into her voice. "Why didn't you call those boys to your office?" Principal Hawkins looked up from his computer, his expression darkening as he met her gaze. "Cool your jets, Laura. Tyler is trouble. I sent him home. Suspended for 2 days." "What?" The word came out louder than she intended, echoing slightly in the large office. "He is the victim. Derek and Chase shoved his head in the sink." Hawkins leaned back in his chair, a condescending smirk playing on his lips. "According to whom?" "According to..." Laura stopped herself before she admitted she lacked witnesses. She had no proof besides Tyler, whom the principal clearly refused to believe. "Tyler came into my class dripping wet, and those boys were laughing about it." "Laughing isn't a crime." Hawkins folded his arms across his chest. "Tyler, on the other hand, came into my office yelling. He started screaming at me when I asked him what happened, then left my office while I was still talking to him." Hawkins's voice rose, his face flushing with anger. "Tyler's mother's current domestic legal battles are clearly making him act out, but I will not have him taking his frustrations out on my nephew." Laura clenched her fists at her sides, struggling to maintain her composure. "Did you ask why he was upset? Did you investigate the incident at all?" Hawkins waved a dismissive hand toward the door. "I don't need to investigate. Tyler Williams has been a discipline problem since he started here. This is just another example." Laura pressed her hands flat against her sides. "That is not fair. Derek and Chase..." Hawkins sliced a hand through the air, cutting her off sharply. "Are excellent students. Derek is my nephew, and I can assure you he has been raised with strong values. I won't have you making baseless accusations against him." The message landed with crystal clarity. Hawkins was protecting them because of who their parents were, and he was warning her not to push the issue. Laura felt the words bubbling up in her throat, the ones she desperately wanted to scream. Caleb was absolutely right about these boys being untouchable. She dropped her gaze, muttering under her breath. Caleb was right. Hawkins's eyes narrowed into dangerous slits. "What was that?" Laura looked up, meeting his gaze directly. For a moment, she considered saying it louder, forcing the issue, and making him acknowledge the injustice. She saw the clear warning in his eyes, though, the stark reminder that he held all the power here and could make her life very difficult if she pushed too hard. She had seen it happen to other teachers who suddenly found themselves scrutinized for every small mistake until they either fell in line or quit. Laura let her voice drop flat. Never mind. She turned and walked out, closing the door behind her with more force than necessary. The hallway was empty. The students already settled in their next classes. Laura stood there, her chest heavy with a suffocating mix of anger and helplessness. She had promised Caleb she would take care of it, but she was just as powerless as he was. Inside his office, Principal Hawkins glared at the closed door. Laura Rivera was usually so compliant and professional, and he wondered what had gotten into her today. This whole morning had been an absolute disaster. First, the website attack with that humiliating tutu image that was probably saved on every student's phone by now. Then Tyler Williams making a scene, and now Laura questioning his judgment. Everything felt like it was spinning out of his control. Hawkins picked up his phone and punched in a short extension. Park, get in here. A minute later, Jason Park appeared in the doorway, a tablet tucked under his arm. Hawkins pointed a rigid finger at the frame. Close the door. Jason complied immediately, his expression carefully neutral as he stood waiting for the inevitable yelling. Hawkins leaned forward, planting his hands flat on the desk. Why did the system force me to reset my password again? It doesn't even let me use my dog's name anymore. Jason kept his expression entirely neutral. When he found out Hawkins used his dog's name and his password each time, he found a way to block it. It's a necessary security feature built into the legacy system, sir. He was trying to hold back some laughter. I still can't figure out why it keeps resetting for you. The old protocols have terrible code smell. We really need that upgrade. Hawkins waved a dismissive hand. I don't want technical jargon. Do you have a name for the website hacker? Hawkins growled. Jason shifted the tablet in his hands, perfectly aware that he possessed absolutely nothing of value. He chose his words with extreme care to avoid setting the man off further. Sir, I don't have a name because the legacy system simply didn't record one. The attack could have come from anywhere, and the logs are completely useless. I need more time to look for secondary digital footprints. Make sure you investigate Tyler. Hawkins jabbed a finger hard at his desk. I think he has motives. Does he have any friends? I think I have seen him with another kid. Do you know who I mean? Jason's expression shifted just slightly as he recognized the dangerous path Hawkins was taking. Yes, if you mean Caleb. He is a bright kid and talented with computers. Mr. Chen was telling me about how he impressed him in programming class last week. I want you to investigate him, Hawkins commanded. Sir? Jason's voice remained careful, though his internal alarm bells were ringing. Based on what evidence? He already regretted mentioning Caleb's talent with programming. Based on the fact that he is a tech whiz, as you just confirmed. Based on the fact that he has the skills to pull off something like this. Hawkins pointed aggressively at his screen, where the tutu image had previously been displayed. Based on the fact that I don't trust any kid who is friends with Tyler. Jason's jaw clenched, almost imperceptibly. The absurdity of treating a harmless, frankly hilarious prank like a federal crime grated on his nerves, but his fear of Hawkins kept his true thoughts locked away. Principal Hawkins, I don't think Caleb is the problem. There is no digital evidence connecting him to the server access. Then find evidence! Hawkins's voice rose to a shout as he slammed his palm on the desk. Or eliminate him as a suspect. Either way, I want answers, and I want them soon. Jason stood there, his tablet still clutched tightly in his hands, his expression completely unreadable. He had worked with this vindictive man for 3 years, and scenes like this were exactly why Jason usually kept his head down. Is there a problem, Park? Hawkins demanded.
No, sir. Jason kept his voice perfectly even.
I just want to make sure we're investigating this properly. Jumping to conclusions without concrete system data could...
Could what? Make us look bad?
Hawkins barked out a harsh laugh. We already look bad. Someone made me look like a fool in front of the entire district. I want whoever did this caught, and I want them punished severely. Is that clear?
Crystal clear, sir, Jason replied smoothly.
Hawkins snapped his attention back to his monitor.
Good. Now get out of my office and do your job.
Jason left without another word, closing the door quietly behind him. Hawkins sat back in his chair, the anger still simmering hot in his chest. The name Caleb circled relentlessly in his mind. The kid fit the exact profile of a troublemaker. Smart, tech-savvy, and quiet. He was the type who would sit in the background, thinking he was better than everyone else, planning something malicious. Hawkins had dealt with kids like that before, and when Caleb slipped up, Hawkins would be there waiting. Jason walked back to his own office, his mind racing with irritation. The direct order to investigate Caleb sat heavy and bitter in his stomach. He settled into his chair and opened his laptop, pulling up Caleb's student file and scanning the information. The screen displayed that Caleb was 16 years old, a junior, with a 2.1 GPA. Jason frowned at the GPA, knowing it didn't match the high-level coding skills Mr. Chen had praised. A 2.1 GPA simply didn't make sense for someone with that level of raw talent. Jason scrolled down to Caleb's disciplinary record and found it completely clean, without a single write-up or tardy. Then he checked the family information, noting a stark line indicating his mother was deceased. Jason stared at that line, feeling a sudden knot form in his stomach. She had been deceased for 2 years, according to the records. It was one thing to fake a technical report to soothe a principal's bruised ego over a ballerina picture. It was another thing entirely to pin a baseless witch hunt on a grieving 16-year-old just because the kid understood computers. Jason rubbed his eyes, thoroughly disgusted. Hawkins wanted him to manufacture a scapegoat out of thin air, because the actual software provided absolutely no answers. Jason's phone buzzed with an incoming email from Principal Hawkins. The subject line read, "Update on investigation," and the message was characteristically brief. "I expect a full report by Monday, no excuses." Jason stared blankly at the email, then back at Caleb's file still open on his screen. Monday was exactly 3 days away. He had 3 days to figure out how to satisfy a vindictive principal without offering up an innocent, grieving kid as a sacrifice for a harmless prank. The entire investigation was a complete joke, but the consequences of failing to produce a believable story were terrifyingly real. Chapter 5. Cold Soup. The bowl of soup sat alone on the kitchen table, no longer steaming. Laura Rivera stared at it from the living room couch, her laptop open but forgotten on her lap. She'd made the soup at 6:30 p.m., tomato basil, Marcus's favorite. It was now 9:47 p.m., and she couldn't believe this was happening again. The apartment was silent, except for the hum of the refrigerator and the distant sound of traffic from the street below. Laura's eyes drifted to the open bedroom door, where a pair of men's dress shoes lay on the floor, exactly where they'd been since this morning. A wrinkled dress shirt hung from the closet door, the same shirt from 2 days ago. The key turned in the lock, but Laura didn't turn around. She kept her eyes on the laptop screen, pretending to read an article she'd already read 3 times. The door opened, closed, and the deadbolt clicked. "Marcus," she said. her voice carefully neutral. Where were you?
Heavy footsteps crossed the hardwood floor.
I had to work.
You're always working. The words came out more bitter than she'd intended.
You're never home since you took that job.
Marcus appeared in her peripheral vision, moving past the couch toward the kitchen table. He pulled out a chair and sat down heavily, and she heard the clink of the spoon against the bowl, followed by a heavy silence.
It's cold, Marcus said flatly.
Laura's hands gripped her laptop. She counted to 5, then 10. She stood up, slammed the laptop shut, and walked into the bedroom, closing the door behind her with enough force to rattle the frame. She sank onto the bed, her chest heavy with frustration. This was their life now, and had been for months. They were ships passing in the night, meals eaten alone, conversations reduced to logistics and complaints. They were not connected anymore. The thought whispered through her mind, unwelcome but undeniable. In the kitchen, Marcus sat with the spoon halfway to his mouth. The bedroom door was closed again. He set the spoon down, the cold soup suddenly unappetizing. The promotion to lead detective had come 8 months ago, and it was everything he'd worked toward. Better pay, more responsibility, respect from his peers, and cases that actually mattered, instead of petty theft and vandalism. It was also 70-hour work weeks, late nights, weekends at the office, and phone calls at all hours. But what she didn't understand, what she refused to understand, was that this wasn't a choice. This was his career, his calling. Every case he worked, every criminal he caught, every victim he gave justice to, it mattered. It meant something. Didn't she see that? Marcus picked up the bowl and carried it to the microwave. He punched in 2 minutes and watched the bowl rotate under the yellow light. When it beeped, he pulled it out, sat back down, and ate without tasting it. He finished half the bowl before his appetite gave out, then rinsed it in the sink and placed it in the dishwasher. The same dishwasher that still had clean dishes from yesterday that neither of them had put away. Marcus grabbed his phone from the counter and sank into the recliner in the living room. His phone buzzed with a text from his partner that read, "Got a lead on the Morrison case. Need you to come in tomorrow, AM." Marcus typed back, "I'll be there." He set the phone down. Marcus glanced at the bedroom, and the light under the door had gone dark. He opened the case file and started reading. The soup bowl sat in the dishwasher, forgotten. In the silence of the apartment, the distance between them grew a little wider. In the bedroom, Laura lay on top of the covers, still fully dressed, staring at the ceiling. She could hear Marcus in the living room, the soft tapping of his fingers on his phone screen, the creak of the recliner as he shifted position. He was working. Always working. She rolled onto her side, facing away from the door, and reached for her phone on the nightstand. She needed something to distract her mind, something to keep her from spiraling into the same dark thoughts she'd been fighting for months. Her friend from the library had recommended a podcast called Truth Applied. Laura had downloaded a few episodes, but never listened. Tonight felt like as good a time as any. She put in her earbuds and scrolled through the episodes until she found one titled Misconceptions About Love. That seemed relevant. She pressed play and closed her eyes, letting the voice fill her ears. The voice introduced himself as Pastor Matthews, and he said he was going to explain how people often misunderstand what love actually means. Laura listened as he explained that love is not the same as doing good. She frowned slightly at that. Wasn't doing good the whole point? Pastor Matthews continued, quoting from the beginning of 1 Corinthians 13, If I give away all I have to the poor, but have not love, I gain nothing. The words hung in the air as he made his point. Doing good things is not inherently love. It could be legalism. Laura's eyes opened at the word legalism, the concept feeling sharp and uncomfortable. She thought about the soup sitting cold on the table. She had made it because she was supposed to, because that's what good wives did. Was it out of obligation? Had she been checking a box so she could feel justified in her anger when he didn't appreciate it? The podcast continued. Pastor Matthews was explaining the other extreme now. Love is also not the same as pleasure or passion. He talked about how the phrase, "I love you," often gets reduced to meaning, "You bring me pleasure." That's not real love, he said. It's probably lust. Seeking pleasure alone is just as empty as doing good alone. Laura stared at the ceiling, biting her bottom lip. She thought about Marcus, about why she had married him in the first place. Had it been love, or was it because of what he could give her? Security, a solution to her loneliness, or children? She had wanted those things and felt that she needed them, but was that love? Or was that just wanting someone to make her feel good? Pastor Matthews's voice pulled her back. Are you actually loving people? Or are you living a lie of legalism or lust? Laura yanked the earbuds out of her ears and tossed her phone onto the nightstand. Her heart was pounding, and she didn't know why. The podcast had barely started, and already she felt exposed. Like someone had pulled back a curtain she hadn't even known was there. She wasn't ready to hear what love actually was. Not tonight. Not when everything felt so broken. She pulled the covers up to her chin, even though she was still fully dressed. Tomorrow was Saturday, with no school. She'd planned to sleep in, maybe make breakfast, and suggest they do something together. Marcus would probably get called in. Just like last weekend, and the one before that. She would be alone with her thoughts and a breakfast for two that only one person would eat. Laura closed her eyes and tried not to think about how cold the soup had been, or how cold everything else had become. Pastor Matthews's words echoed in her mind anyway. Doing good could be legalism. Pursuing pleasure could be lust. She pushed the thoughts away and waited for sleep that wouldn't come. Chapter 6. The Gym Encounter. Marcus woke at 5:47 a.m., his eyes snapping open to the pre-dawn darkness of the bedroom. He lay still for a moment, listening to Laura's breathing beside him, slow and even. She was still asleep. He had snuck in bed and lay down around midnight when she was already asleep. He should be sleeping, too. His body certainly needed it after the long hours he'd been putting in at the precinct. But his mind wouldn't shut off. It kept circling back to last night. To the cold soup. To the slammed door. To the silence that followed. Marcus slid out of bed carefully, not wanting to wake her. He pulled on his gym clothes in the dim light filtering through the window. And grabbed his gym bag that had his work clothes ready for him to change into later. In the kitchen, he paused at the dishwasher. The soup bowl was still there, along with the other dishes they'd both been too stubborn to put away. He left without eating. The gym was nearly empty this early on a Saturday morning, just a handful of dedicated regulars scattered among the equipment, each person locked into their own routine. Marcus liked it this way. Quiet, no small talk, no forced pleasantries. He had only joined this gym a week ago. This one had better equipment than his previous workout place. He headed straight for the heavy bag in the corner. The first punch landed with a satisfying thud, then another and another. Marcus fell into the rhythm, working through combinations he'd learned years ago. Jab, cross, hook. His body remembered the movements, even if he didn't train as often as he used to. He had started martial arts when he was 8. "You need to learn to defend yourself," his old man had said. "The world isn't kind to weak men." Marcus had earned a brown belt by 16, which was just a couple of notches below a black belt, and he still knew how to throw a solid punch. Somewhere along the way, fighting stopped being about competition and became an outlet to channel his anger. The bag swung harder with each strike. He thought about Laura and the way she had looked at him last night, before slamming the laptop shut. His fist connected with the heavy cylinder with more force than he intended, sending it arcing out in a dangerous pendulum. Marcus stepped in to throw a follow-up hook, completely misjudging the timing. The 100-pound bag swung back and slammed squarely into his chest. It knocked him right off his feet and launched him flat onto his back on the gym mat. "I think the bag won that round," a voice observed. Marcus groaned and looked up to see a man standing over him, holding a water bottle. The man offered a hand and pulled Marcus to his feet. "Thanks," Marcus muttered, brushing himself off while his face burned. "I lost my rhythm." "Happens to the best of us," the man chuckled. He gestured toward an older woman in a pastel tracksuit a few yards away. She was moving her arms in extremely slow, peaceful circles with her eyes closed. "Maybe boxing isn't your thing. You might want to try what she is doing. Tai Chi has a much lower chance of the air fighting back." Marcus let out a surprised breath that was almost a laugh as he rubbed his aching chest. "I actually have a brown belt. I grew up fighting." "Could have fooled me," the man smiled and took a seat on a nearby bench. "But seriously, before the bag retaliated, you were hitting that thing like it owed you money. You seem like you have something on your mind. This looks like more than exercise." Marcus caught the bag mid-swing and held it still, turning to look at the stranger. "What makes you say that?" "Just an observation." The man's expression was open and friendly, not prying, just present. "You don't have to talk about it. I just noticed." Marcus grabbed his water bottle and took a long drink. He should walk away. This guy was a stranger. He didn't need to spill his problems to some random person at the gym, but somehow, the words came anyway. "My marriage is falling apart." Marcus set the bottle down harder than necessary. "I'm considering divorce." The man's expression remained steady, showing no shock. "That's rough. I'm sorry." "You married?" Marcus asked.
"Yeah. 13 years now."
"Lucky you." Marcus crossed his arms. The man laughed, but it wasn't unkind. "Not always. I've had problems in my marriage, too. Almost ended in divorce after 7 years in." Marcus looked up sharply. "That's where we're at, too. 7 years. It's actually pretty common around then." The man leaned forward, elbows on his knees. "The 7-year itch is real. It's when the initial excitement wears off, and you're left with the real work of staying together." "So what happened? How'd you fix it?" Marcus asked. "We didn't fix it overnight, but we learned some things that turned it around." The man paused, his eyes thoughtful. "Are you interested in hearing what helped us?" Marcus considered lying, saying no, walking away. But the truth was, he was desperate. "Yes. I'll probably lose everything if we divorce." The man nodded slowly. "Can I show you something?" He pulled a small notebook from his gym bag and sketched something quickly, then turned it toward Marcus. It was like a line graph, with different sections marked off and labeled. The line first swooped upward steeply,
and then turned down just as quickly as it had climbed. Next, it slowly went back up, where it leveled off. "This is what someone taught me when my marriage was at its worst," the man said. "It's called the relational maturity map. It's a graph to help you understand where you are in the maturity of your relationship. The vertical axis is how much connection and rapport that people feel toward each other. The horizontal axis is how familiar and how much people collaborated together." He pointed to the first section, where the lines swooped upward. "When you first get together, you start here. Reciprocal. I call it the honeymoon phase. Everything is give and take. You're both trying to impress each other, be your best selves. It's easy because you're not really depending on each other yet. You're just exchanging favors. The math is simple. 1 + 1 = 2. You both benefit equally." Marcus looked at him with some curiosity. "So for a marriage relationship, there is lots of fun, lots of sex, no real problems," he said with a bitter edge to his voice. "Exactly." The man nodded. "Maybe you travel together, go on dates, enjoy each other. If there are kids, they're easy babies who sleep through the night and don't cry all the time. This stage usually lasts the first few years, longer if life stays easy and stress-free." His finger moved to the next section, where the line turned and went down. "Then you hit disillusionment. This is the reality check. The masks come off, and you realize that actually collaborating on life together is a lot harder than just exchanging favors. You have to sacrifice for each other, and someone is going to get the short end of the stick at times. The math changes. 1 + 1 starts equaling less than 2. You're both struggling, trying to pick up the slack, and the initial excitement wears off." "What makes people move there?" Marcus asked, leaning in. "Life changes, usually. Trying to actually raise kids together instead of just taking turns. Family stress, work pressure." The man paused. "Financial problems or debt. Anything that forces you to truly depend on each other instead of just coexisting. Most relationships hit this somewhere between 2 and 6 years in." Marcus nodded. That sounded familiar. He remembered the transition. "If you keep going without the right tools, you hit the trenches." The man tapped a section that dipped down on the diagram. It was the lowest point of the graph. "This is the danger zone. This is where most marriages fail. The math here is brutal. 1 + 1 = nearly 0. You're not just struggling anymore. You're actively working against each other. Fighting constantly, or worse, ignoring each other completely. In marriage, you wonder why you ever got married in the first place. That's us." Marcus stared at the drawing. "We're definitely in the trenches." "Most couples are, at some point." The man met his eyes. "You usually get here when you discover you have fundamentally different beliefs about the world, about who you are, about how to handle problems. That's what creates the real friction. Statistically, divorce rates peak around the 7 to 8 year mark. That's not a coincidence." "So what's past the trenches?" Marcus leaned in closer to the diagram. The man's finger moved to the next section, where the line slowly moved up toward the right. "If you survive the trenches but don't have the right skills, you end up in compromise. The math improves a little. 1 + 1 = somewhere between 1 and 1.5. You figure out how to coexist without destroying each other. You lower your standards and accept losing sometimes just to keep the peace. Problems get stuffed down, denied, overlooked." He shook his head. "Most marriages never get past this stage. They settle here permanently because they don't have the tools to go higher." "What about the top?" Marcus pointed to where the line leveled off at its highest point. Synergy. That's the goal. The man's voice warmed. The math flips completely. 1 + 1 = 2, 3, or more. You're actually stronger together than you would be apart. There's mutual understanding and high trust. You function as a team with shared goals. He tapped the paper firmly. Here's the key. Your differences stop being sources of conflict and start being assets. You see your spouse's different perspective as something that completes your picture instead of something that threatens it. One other thing to remember is that synergy is not attained. It is maintained. People can slide down the slope of compromise toward the trenches, but consistent, healthy collaboration can keep them at their peak. Marcus studied the map. So the trenches aren't the end? Only if you quit there. The man closed the notebook. The trenches are actually just part of the journey. A hard part, but not the final destination. Nobody just shows up in synergy. You have to work to get there. There's no shortcut, but people can bridge the trenches if they have the right skills to work through conflict. Unfortunately, most people don't have the skills and give up in the trenches. They never realize that synergy even exists, that there's something better than reciprocal relationships waiting for them if they push through. Marcus sat down on the bench beside him, his legs suddenly feeling heavy. "I don't know if we can get out of the trenches," he admitted, his shoulders sagging. "We barely talk anymore, and when we do, we just fight. That's what the trenches feel like." The man's voice was gentle but firm. "You're not stuck there unless you choose to be. If you quit, you will just start over with the next relationship, working through the same process. You're already halfway to synergy. Do you want to get there?" They sat in silence for a moment. Around them, the gym continued its morning routine with weight machines clanging, treadmills humming, and people moving through their exercises, oblivious to the conversation happening in the corner. Marcus thought about Laura, about the soup, about the way they'd been living the past few months, like ships passing in the night. Was it really possible to get out of this? "I should get back to my workout," the man said, standing and tucking the notebook back into his bag. "Think about it, though. The trenches are temporary if you're willing to do the work." "Thanks." Marcus looked up at him. "I mean it." The man nodded and headed toward the free weights. Marcus grabbed his water bottle and stood. He was done at the gym, but maybe he wasn't done with his marriage. He'd spent the last couple of months assuming his marriage was over. What if it wasn't? What if they were just in the trenches? Thank you for listening to this preview of How Harmony Happens, a fable for hacking the conflict cycle. If you enjoyed this preview and would like to get this book or find more available titles on personal and professional development by Peter Schrock, please go to togethertransformed.com. Copyright 2026 by Peter Schrock. All rights reserved. No portion of this audiobook may be copied, distributed, or reproduced without prior written consent from the publisher.